I want to introduce you to Nora Vincent, who was a nationally syndicated columnist from the Los Angeles Times, gave that job up to become Ned Vincent. Not permanently and not biologically, but in disguise and undercover and every other way, she became Ned for a year and a half to live life as a man. She writes about those experiences in her new book, Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. And I welcome her here to KMOX this afternoon. Hi, Nora. How are you?
Hi, Paul.
Is that Nora's voice or Ned's voice?
That's Nora's voice.
What does Ned's voice sound like?
Ned would have said, hey, Paul, how you doing?
So there wasn't all that much of a difference between the voices, just the attitude.
Yeah, the attitude, but, you know, it was deeper, definitely. I said, hi, Paul, and Ned said, hey, Paul, what's up?
In this 18 months, did you ever answer the phone in the wrong voice?
I did, actually, yeah, because I gave out my cell phone number to use as Ned's number, and every now and again I would just, you know, be thinking about something else or whatever else, and yeah, and suddenly I'd have to say, they'd say, is Ned there? And I'd say, yeah.
So you can say, hold on just a second. Hello.
Exactly.
Why did you do this, Nora?
I really just wanted to know the answer, the million-dollar question, I guess, was, you know, is it still a man's world, and do men have it better in every way, which I think a lot of women still think. And I think a lot of women, just as a lot of men, probably want to know what's it like on the other side of the fence. And so I sort of figured I had the tools at my disposal, so I thought I'd give it a shot.
What tools were those?
Well, I think I have one of those faces that, you know, I've got large features, and they're the kind of features that I think can lend themselves to this kind of transformation in a way that certain women's features just couldn't. I'm also, you know, tall for a woman, sort of average size for a guy, 5'10", and I've got enormous feet, which I generally have to buy men's shoes anyway because my feet are 11.5 men's. So
wow. I wear a 12, so I know what you're talking about here.
Yeah, so, I also have a fairly deep voice for a woman, so I was able to kind of use all those things, and you know, that's something that a lot of women wouldn't have been able to do, and it just, I'd been really inspired by people like Orwell, who, you know, did Down and Out in Paris and London, lived as a homeless man, that kind of thing. Aaron Reich, certainly, doing Nickel and Dimed, and of course, Black Like Me, John Howard Griffin, living as a black man. So I think it was the kind of journalism I really wanted to do. I didn't want to write about politics anymore. I wanted to really just kind of, instead of trying to pretend I knew the answers to the questions, just ask the questions and see what I found out.
All right, before we get into the deep philosophical part of this, let's get through the superficial stuff.
All right.
How did you give yourself a 5 o'clock shadow?
I used crepe hair, which is just made of wool, and it's used in wigs and a lot of things like that. You can buy it in any color, and it looks a lot like real hair. And I cut it with a man's beard trimmer into the tiniest pieces I could manage, so it would look like the kind of thing that if you shaved a couple days stubble off, you know, what it falls around the sink. That's kind of the length I was going for. And I put it on a white piece of paper, sprinkled it out pretty evenly, and then I used this stuff called Stopple Paste, which is kind of a clear glue that they use in theater, but it's made of lanolin and beeswax, so it doesn't rip up your skin, and you can't see it. And then I would just put, I took a makeup brush and just pasted the flecks of hair onto my face to look like a 5 o'clock shadow.
How long did it take you to get it looking right the first time?
Oh, God, I don't know, probably at least an hour, probably hour and a half.
But by the end of the 18 months, it was probably 5 minutes.
Probably 15. 15 was probably, I it took a while to cut the hair just because you had to kind of do it carefully. But, yeah, I could do it pretty quickly by the end.
Were you Ned every day for 18 months?
No, I wasn't every day. For certain periods. For example, when I went to the monastery, I stayed there for 3 weeks in the cloister, so there I was every day. I had to put it
on. Yeah, that would surprise them if you woke up in the morning and decided, you know what, I'm just going to be Nora today.
I just scampered down the hall in a dress, yeah. I don't think so. So on those occasions, or like when I worked as a salesman for a while, for that month, I was pretty much every day, you know, I was going to work and that kind of thing. But then there were other times when I would take time off, especially during the hottest months of the year, because the thing about it is, you know, you basically have wool on your face, and I'm one of those people who tends to sweat on my face, and so the sweat would start to make the glue and the hair move and run and that kind of thing. And so I really had to avoid sweating too much.
In fact, you talk in the book about being in a therapy session in the basement of some place with no air conditioning, and it was hot and hot, 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 hot. And all you were worried about was your face, right?
Yeah. I would just be sitting there patting. I'd have like a handkerchief with me. You know, I'm sure people thought that was a really strange affectation, and I'd be just dabbing at it because if I got the sweat off quickly enough, it wouldn't melt the beard. But all I'd be thinking about in the hot room is, can we just crank the air?
What did you do to transform the rest of your body?
I went to a trainer and I asked him, you know, I didn't want to take hormones, but I wanted to build up. He suggested building up my shoulders and arms as much as I could. And, you know, I basically trained every part of my body, but that was where I wanted to square off more. And he said, you know, you got to eat a lot of protein, basically your body weight in grams of protein every day, and lift every day. And I did that for about 6 months, and I gained probably about 15 pounds of muscle.
And you had to bind your chest?
Yep, and I decided, I used an ACE bandage at first to do that, but it became very tight and I couldn't really breathe and it would move around. So I decided to use a flat-fronted sports bra that was two sizes too small. I'm pretty small-breasted anyway, so it wasn't like I was trying to hide a lot there. So that worked pretty well. And then I would just have kind of creative layering over the top. Or if I was wearing a suit jacket, it was great.
One of the things that I found interesting is that the handshake was a tough thing to figure out in the first place. Because men and women don't shake hands similarly?
Well, it was just one of the things that early on really surprised me, and I hadn't expected to, because when women tend to see, you see guys shaking hands, I had described it like when you see guys watching, like the Super Bowl is coming up, and, they'll go into some guy's living room, and they'll be like, hey, what's up? And, they shake hands, and it looks very, all this sort of macho ceremony, and you're thinking, what's that all about, But from the inside out, it was a totally different experience. I mean, I was amazed by how welcoming guys that I'd never met before, who'd never met Ned before, just when they would shake my hand, there was this presumption of goodwill, like there was suddenly this buddy bonding secret world of men, that generally speaking, when you meet another guy, I thought that most men would be, the kind of wolfish around each other and kind of, competitive right from the start. And that's actually more typical of women. And, in my experience, when you shake hands with a woman you've never met before, often there's this kind of, there's a lot of fakery about it. It's kind of a suspicious, kind of strange thing. We're kind of raised to be competitive with each other. And I just, it was a striking contrast with guys that I didn't expect.
But you say in the book, or maybe I'm just inferring from the book, that while men do have that immediate kind of handshake friendliness, there's still some fear when men get together. What's that fear about?
Well, it's an interesting layering that happens because, of course, there are different levels of friendship and degrees that women and men can experience. And I think I found a lot that there was this, especially in this men's encounter group that I joined. It was an offshoot of a Robert Bly kind of inspired thing. And, the guys would sit around and really talk the most openly of any of the guys that I ever met. And I think that they would talk a lot about how, you don't expose yourself to another guy. There are rules. Like the first time I ever went out in drag, I noticed that guys don't look each other in the eye. Like if you hold another guy's gaze, that's against the rules. And I learned that over time as a guy, but I also talked to a lot of guys about that. And they said, because that either means it's a threat or a challenge, or it means you're trying to come on to the guy. So there are these rules that you have to follow that are, in a way, they're kind of animalistic. It's sort of like it keeps the peace. And so I think there's a certain amount of, fear about, just it's doing the wrong thing and offending somebody and getting into a kind of a tussle, or also just keeping yourself emotionally in a place where another guy can't harm you. I think, men are generally raised to hold in their emotions and to just not allow another guy close enough to see what's happening.
Has it been your experience that women are the opposite, leaving themselves open and vulnerable?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, again, there are these nuances, but yeah, I think generally speaking, women, when we, after those initial kind of suspicious meetings, I think we tend to enjoy maybe, I wouldn't say deeper friendships, but there's a different level of communication that's culturally acceptable for women, so that we tend to overspeak everything. We tend to talk about every nuance of everything that's happening in our lives with our girlfriends. And there's a certain therapeutic value to that, and I think that men are often denied that. I think we are so different the sexes, that you really do need someone of your own sex to really get some of the things that happened to you and really understand your experience and commiserate. And I think when guys get together, what I noticed, you know, which again, it's not necessarily a revelation, but to watch the ways in which guys try to communicate with each other without using the kind of language that women use, because they've been denied that. So I learned a lot about what's said, for example, in the silences between men. You know, there's a lot of kind of attunement that happens because you can't say it overtly, so you just kind of have to do it in a different way. And it was, I described it sort of like, you know, hearing sounds that only dogs can hear. You
know? So you had to learn a whole new language.
Yeah, just a very, and so, you know, as I say, I think though some people have talked about the way in which men and women converse differently, to experience it firsthand was really an amazing thing, to feel like the female who was always expecting, you know, my antennae are always twitching and thinking, okay, so these guys, what does this particular, you know, gesture mean, or what is this particular, we're always doing that with other people. And with the guys, I started, yeah, to learn what the gestures meant or what the silences meant and how, for example, if a guy was showing an emotion, you know, it was how to respond to that. As a woman, you'd probably throw your arms around another woman and you'd cry and you'd have this overt sort of whole ceremony that happens. Whereas with guys, you know, I learned that that's exactly the wrong thing to do, even as a woman, but especially as a guy to another guy. You're not going to put your arms around him. You got to give him some space. It's an embarrassing thing to show an emotion in front of another guy. So, you know, it was just a whole nother language I had to learn.
Come here, Mike. Cry on my shoulder. Just doesn't happen. So you went to this Robert Bly-like retreat with these guys, and you sat around and talked with them a lot. And I've never been to one of these things. How weird did it get for you? Was there a point where you said, oh, man, these guys are screwed up?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is an element of that, you know, and it's unfortunate because I do think that in a way then the men's movement has been kind of a small group. I don't think there are very many men who have been to these groups, and they've gotten kind of a bad reputation, and probably in some ways rightly so, because, you know, it's like the worst sometimes of New Age groups, where there's a lot of good will on the table, but there are a lot of people who are really just not in a good place, and they're really just looking for, I mean, they're so messed up that you just sort of think, how am I going to get anything out of talking to these people? So it was interesting because I really understood that what they were trying to do in terms of having men communicate intimately with each other and talk about their problems openly was really therapeutic. I thought that the people that were involved weren't making it easy for, they wouldn't make it easy for, say, someone like you, I don't know, to come in and feel comfortable doing that. And I would like to see it happen more often. I think it'd be a good thing for guys to be able to do, but I think they need to form those groups themselves rather maybe than joining these sort of prefabricated groups.
All right, I'm going to take a break here in a moment here, and we're going to come back from that and talk about your dating life as a man, dating women, your job, you're going to strip clubs, all of the sort of topics that you cover in the book here. But I do have to ask this question in light of recent events. How do I know that everything you're saying here is real? How do I know I'm not being James Fried? I'm Oprah and you're James Fry, Nora.
Yeah, well, you're not, because I have witnesses at every stage. There were people there, and in fact, people who have shown themselves in public and on television who have testified that I did what I said I did.
I'm not going to see you on the smoking gun anytime soon?
Not at all.
The book is called Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. Nora Vincent, Ned Vincent. Two in the same, here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Nora Vincent, freelance journalist who spent a year and a half as a guy and writes about it in her new book, Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. On the cover, there's a striking photo of her as Nora and a striking photo of her as her alter ego, Ned, who, by the way, could easily double as Robert Downey Jr.
Other people have said that. That's so funny you say that.
Who else did people tell you looked like?
Jake Gyllenhaal. I don't know, I can't remember now some of the others, but, you know, people seem to think there was a definite Robert Downey Jr. thing going on there.
Yeah, I think so, too. My engineer says you look like Mo Rocca. I'm not sure that's a good thing.
I don't know either.
Let's talk a little bit about you and men on the dating front. You are a lesbian, and so you know about dating women. What was it like to be a man dating a woman?
Well, it was a very different experience. You know, that was the thing. I thought that it would be similar because, yeah, I'd been on dates with women for many years, and it was an entirely different experience. And, of course, I was coming at this as a woman inside NID's shell, so to speak, and I was coming at it with all of my normal sort of ways of going about these things. And to sit down across the table from a woman and suddenly feel like you're not sharing that common language of womanhood, you know, the cultural language that we enjoy. And I always felt when I was dating women that it was, you were meeting as equals in a way. And as a guy, I felt suddenly that all of those signals were, again, we were at cross purposes, you know, that I the language was being misunderstood, and that the women were certainly bringing a lot of prejudice, I guess, to the table. I felt often a kind of a hostility and a judgmentalness coming my way.
On dates?
Yeah, yeah.
Why?
Well, I mean, I think they a lot of the women that I met, you know, talked a lot about men who had hurt them in the past, or they, you know, as I said, when I first shook hands with men, there was a presumption of goodwill, and with women, there was a presumption that of sort of ill will in a way, or a presumption that you were a cad until you proved otherwise, you know, and that's kind of a hard barrier to, you know, to start a date with, this feeling that, you know, there's a lot of political or cultural baggage that's coming at you, and then in some cases, obviously, it's personal baggage. But it was something I felt fairly commonly, you know, and it was an unpleasant thing to feel that you were behind the eight ball right from the get-go.
Did you get that in not even in dating situations, but just in women that you dealt with as a man, that they had that attitude of, oh, guys are jerks?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that there was a lot of, you know, feeling that that you sort of, wariness was another feeling I felt, you know. I mean, there were times when certainly when there was flirtation happening. I mean, that did happen as well. But it, yeah, there was this sense that there was a lot, for example, that I could say as a woman that I wouldn't be able to say as a guy, you know, that there would, that I, and, you know, one of my dates was a sort of an extreme example, I guess, but, you know, she just said some amazingly hostile things, just exposing the prejudices. Like she said, you know, well, you know, I think a man's 35 is pretty much equal to a woman's 23, you know, and all of these sort of things about how immature guys are and all that. And that was the assumption she was coming to the date with, you know, and that was not that uncommon.
Nora, I think you were Robert Downey Jr.
I was tossed around with a bad lot, I guess.
I think so. I think that it's the attraction of Robert Downey Jr. that brought you to these same kind of women. It sounds like the same thing to me. Now, how would you make a date with these women?
Often, most of the time, I met these people online.
Okay, so it's not like you were going to a bar as Ned and hitting on them.
Well, I did do that. That was another part of the thing, and that was really unpleasant. I mean, that was just, you know, rejection after rejection, which women will, you know, just never understand, because most women never, again, culturally, it's not expected for women to be the ones to cross the room and make the play, whatever. And I think it's hard to do that. It takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of emotional energy to work up the guts to do it, and then to say something that doesn't sound kind of, you know, ridiculous or embarrassing. And there's just, again, there was this feeling I had from a lot of these women that, well, you know, I've got all the goods. What do you have to show for yourself? And I just thought, well, you know, I don't know if you really do have all the goods, but you clearly think you do.
That is absolutely the most difficult thing about being a single guy, and I haven't been one for about half of my life. But as a single guy, when you see a person who you might be attracted to and you want to start in, first you got to get past that, well, she thinks I'm a jerk thing. And then there's the, okay, I have about 8 seconds here. Is that about how long it takes?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And or less, I'd say. You know, they really, I mean, I just got these looks. You know, you walk up to, you know, sometimes, often these women would be in groups. They wouldn't be alone. And so that's even harder. You're walking up to a woman who's with a group of her friends, and they all sort of turn to look at you. You know, I said sort of like inferior produce at the supermarket or something, you know, and you feel their eyes sort of go over you, and then they, you know, half the time they would just turn away, or they would look at you as, you know, as if, well, I'm tolerating you for the moment, but you're annoying me, you know, leave me alone. And yeah, so I think that's really hard, but yet that's the way the game's played.
Did you find it exactly the opposite when you went into the workplace?
Well, I would say I certainly experienced the most of the male privilege that I experienced in the workplace, or I would say around the workplace, because part of that was how I was dressed and then how I was treated, because I would be wearing a jacket and a tie as opposed to, say, you know, a jean shirt or a flannel shirt. And I noticed that there was a lot of, you know, deference that was coming my way, even just in waiters and waitresses, but also, you know, in interviews, what was expected of me and what I could get away with saying. You know, again, just as a guy, there were things I couldn't say to women. In interviews, I felt like there were things I could say as a guy that, you know, coming from a woman, you they would just look at you like, "What? Who do you think you are?" You know. But coming from a guy, they kind of expected you to brag about yourself openly, and that was, you know, that's something that, you know, the language of guys, you know, that kind of thing. And so I did that, and I responded to the cues that people were giving me about how to behave, and I did feel a certain entitlement, you know, descend on me, and a certain license to brag.
You went into a sales job, a hard, cold call sale, kind of like a Glengarry Glen Ross kind of job. You went through a few of them, actually. Did you find it easier when you were Ned, when you were the man that you were pretending to be, to deal with a male client or a female client?
Usually I found it easier, actually, to deal with a female client. But interestingly, what I found most notable about that was that I was trying to pitch as a woman, and, you know, in general, you know, they try to teach you these techniques that you're supposed to use whether you're a man or a woman, but what you learn as a salesperson, if you're a good one, is that the rules are meant to be broken, and what you really learn is how to get around them and how to maneuver people. I mean, a sale is a kind of a flirtation, and it's a kind of a you're molding this person to your will, essentially. So to do that as a woman in a man's body came off really as off color. You know, I was kind of asking for the sale, kind of cajoling, you know, and that just, you know, as I said in the book, people see weakness in a man or a kind of a vulnerability, and they want to stamp it out. They see it in a woman and they want to help, you know, or they want to, that's perfectly acceptable for a woman to kind of flirt her way into the sale or kind of slide in sideways, whereas, you know, the guy, you're supposed to take the sale, you're supposed to command the whole thing. And, you know, so that it was less about the client that I was dealing with and more about what they were, you know, just whether man or woman, what they expected from me as a guy.
The book is called Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. Nora Vincent as Ned Vincent for 18 months. We'll talk more in a moment on The Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Nora Vincent, who spent a year and a half as Ned Vincent. She writes about her experiences 18 months as a man in her book, Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. By the way, why Ned?
That was a nickname from childhood that my brothers used. I was a tomboy as a kid, and I figured, you know, if you're going to be an imposter, you better respond to the name that people use, and I thought that would be the best.
And when you were not Ned, but Nora, did you refer to Ned in the third person?
Always, yeah. He was, for me, psychologically, it kind of helped to keep him as a separate. He was a creation, a kind of a character that I created, so he wasn't me.
Did you ever run into any of your friends as Ned?
Sometimes I did, yeah. Sometimes during people I knew, and they would have to try to decide if I was with somebody, they would have to assume, okay, well, you know, this person doesn't know about what's happening, so I've got to play along, and that often, you know, yielded some funny situations.
I bet. But were there also friends of yours who didn't know what you looked like as Ned, or that you were doing this experiment, and so when they met you, they really thought they were meeting some guy named Ned Vincent?
No, that never happened, actually. But
hey, Ned Vincent, I have a friend, Nora Vincent.
Yeah, you must have a sister, right?
Have you heard from any of the people, since the book's been out about 2 weeks now, have you heard from any of the people you deceived?
I have, actually. It's been great. You were asking me about the James Frey thing, and that's another reason why, aside, as I said, from the fact that some of them were interviewed on television, but I've sent the book to a lot of the people that I knew as Ned. And, for example, one of the monks who's now been made abbot of the monastery that he was in, you know, wrote and said it was really like a mirror. I mean, you really saw some amazing things about this community, and, you know, so really validated what I had to say. And he said I thought it was a very balanced treatment of what you experienced here. And, you know, similarly, the bowling guys, you know, one of them, you know, that I've stayed friendly with, he called up to just say, you know, I thought it was really great, and it was like just being back there again, that kind of thing. So, you know, there was a lot of validation that I think I got it right, you know, and that they appreciated what I'd done.
When you did this, you did it all over the country. You don't say in the book where it happened.
Mm-hmm.
When you would leave one place, not knowing you weren't going back there as Ned, did you take anybody aside and say, by the way, my real name is Nora?
Yeah, I did that pretty much in every case, with, I guess, the exception of the men's group. I didn't do that until, you know, after the book came out. There was one guy at the sales job that I did tell about it, although that's actually not in the chapter. But I didn't tell the, you know, the bosses or anything like that. But in almost every other case, I did take people aside and tell them, because I learned a lot, actually, through the process of telling people.
I bet this was a thrill at the beginning, but I'm also betting at a certain point it got old.
Yeah, it really did. It got incredibly tiring, and of course, in the end, it really precipitated a breakdown for me. I mean, I really just became very depressed and exhausted.
Actually went to a psych ward.
Yeah, because it was really, I mean, part of that was just being an imposter, you know, trying to play a character and be someone that you're not for a long period of time is very hard. It's a really big emotional burden, but also, you know, trying to be someone of the opposite sex when you're not a transsexual and you don't want to be a member of that, you know, I found it to be a pretty much overall an unpleasant experience. I felt it limiting in a way that I didn't feel, I couldn't be myself, really, and that was really hard. So after a while, it got me really depressed, and yeah, I decided I'd just check myself into a ward for a few days.
Is that why you stopped at 18 months, or had you always planned on doing 18 months?
I had planned on doing it that long, but I did actually finish a little bit early because of the breakdown.
Yeah. Nora, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you this question.
Sure.
Did you use the urinal?
I didn't, because the prosthesis that I had did not perform that function. So I actually did have to go into the stalls, and that was always interesting to navigate because, you know, most guys don't do that. They use the urinal, so
yeah.
It's a little strange. But, you know, it's a public restroom. Most guys are not going to be paying too much attention to what another guy's doing.
No, in fact, you may have discovered during your 18 months that we have an unwritten men's room rule, which is no talking.
Yeah, and no looking, definitely no looking. I mean, you know, women think, oh, guys, how can guys do that where they're peeing right in front of each other? And, of course, but there's a lot of that whole thing about the eyes, like, don't you look over here. You know, we may be standing next to each other, but that doesn't mean you need to look.
In our heads, this is what, if you could crack open our heads and listen, you'd hear this. La-dee-da-da. Not paying attention to anything. I'm just taking care of business and getting out of here. As opposed to women who will go in there and have a conference.
Yeah, exactly.
Had you ever been in a men's room before this?
I had, I think, maybe once before, but it was kind of a shocking experience. You know, you see that whole row of urinals. It was really very strange, and the smells were very different, of course, and, you know, so it's kind of arresting in an animal level. You just sort of think, I don't belong here. This is really awful.
Yeah. Every guy's going, yeah, we know the smell. We know about it.
Yeah, right.
Just deal with it.
This is home.
And you also, in addition to dating women, you went and saw naked women.
I did. I went to strip clubs, yeah.
And how bizarre was that? You know,
I was
actually telling Nora, excuse me for interrupting, I was telling Nora during the break that she did things in this book that I've never done. She went on a men's retreat. She got lap dances. I've never done these things, so I'm actually reading the book and going, huh, that's what that's like. How bizarre was it?
Well, it was very strange, too, because, of course, as a woman, I think, you know, there are plenty of men who haven't been to strip clubs, although given the prevalence of them and the prevalence of the porn industry, I think it's a pretty widespread phenomenon that this is enjoyable or it's, you know, it's something that a lot of guys do. But I also found that it was kind of an unpleasant atmosphere, even for the clientele, it seemed. You know, there was a lot of unhappiness, it seemed to me, being expressed there, and maybe a kind of a desperation of male sexuality, not being able to sort of know where to put these urges that these guys had. And, you know, it was just, as a woman, I think, you know, typically we tend to surround the sex act with a lot more emotional and intellectual and whatever else baggage than men do in general. And so I think I just found it more jarring probably than most men would. And, you know, even as a woman who's attracted to other women, I just, it couldn't have really turned me off more or depressed me more. You know, the last thing I think I could have felt in those places is sexually aroused.
So, you, as we said, you're a lesbian, but here you are getting a lap dance from another woman who thinks you're a man. There wasn't anything inside you going, hey, I'm into this.
No, you know, I thought that there would be some kind of a thrill to it, just even in the costume or something, you know. But also, I think the way that the strippers treat the male clientele, you know, talk about hostility. I mean, and probably understandably so, given what they do for a living. But they kind of see men at their worst, you know, and so they treat you like kind of an ape with a wallet attached. You know? And that's not exactly the most, you know, because you're thinking to yourself, okay, I'm a human being, you know, and so.
Yeah, not so much in there.
Yeah.
How did you not laugh the first time somebody said, you're the man, Ned?
Or, you know, they say that other thing that I guess I probably can't say, but, you know, about referring to the nether regions and your manhood.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, I would always get a good little chuckle out of that, you know.
This is a fascinating read, as I said, not just for the experiences that I've never had myself, but also to see what you learned about this and what I think both women and men can learn about the differences. Because, you know, the whole thing about women's equality was not a matter of we have to be exactly like men. It was about we have to have the same opportunities as men. But some people, particularly some people who are against the ERA and other things, they always misread that. And I think what they should do is pick up your book and get a good read on what the real differences are. And I also want to point out that you came to the conclusion that men have it harder than women will ever know. And
yes.
I find that fascinating.
You don't hear discussed very often. I think we all know what women's complaints have been. We've written about them at length, probably ad nauseum. And I think that men have plenty of complaints about their role, and their role was a straitjacket just as much as ours. And they have not really been liberated from that role, especially emotionally. So, yeah.
No man's going to write that, so it took a woman to do it.
Yeah.
Nora, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
The book is called Self-Made Man, One Woman's Journey into Manhood and Back Again. Nora Vincent here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.